Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. It is early May 2016, which actually isn't all that important because I deal with historical issues that never really don't have an expiration date. One of the things about dealing with history, especially in Russia and Ukraine, is that nothing ever seems to change. The same alliances, the same enemies, the same ideologies, the same excuses over and over again. I'm a little late this week. I apologize for that. I had a bit of a health crisis early on, but I am back 100%. And I thank the patience of people like Sven Longshanks, who's been very long suffering with me, although it's not my fault this time. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. I am the senior researcher for Russian politics at the Barnes Review, a position that I've had in different titles for a long time. I was hired right out of grad school by Willis Cardo in 1999. And now, I think I've mentioned this before, but I'm in the process of reorganizing the institutions that Willis Cardo created with Paul Angel and Chris Pethrick. We've known each other for a long time, and we trust each other. And it's very important that my listeners know that. Because of Barnes Review and Willis Cardo, this is the antidote to the universities. As many of you know, I was professor at four universities in my career. I'm only 44. So I know academia from the inside. And I survived largely because I'm a nice guy. People like me, personally. The key is, if you're at a university, make sure that you're friends with the professors and your other students first. And then, once they know that you're a decent person, then you can begin talking about the ideological issues. It can't be the reverse. Because if they don't know you or dislike you, you know, they'll do whatever they can to get rid of you. But once they know that you're a decent guy, they're just going to take what you say as an eccentricity, and it'll end up being a joke between you guys. And that's exactly what happened to me. In grad school, I developed a personality that separated the political differences from our personal relationship, whether among the other students or professors. And that's what got me through. But there's no excuse for people who claim that, you know, I wasn't able to go to grad school because of the ideological walls that were thrown up. I faced the same walls, and I won. That's very important that you realize that the method is to make sure that you are friends with them first. They know that you're a normal guy, a decent guy, and then you can begin talking politically. Then they usually, there's not much they're going to do to a friend of theirs. They already know you're a decent person. This is extremely important if you want to succeed in academia. My enemies, however, were those outside of the academy who would then call in and say, you know, Johnson is a problem, and you need to get rid of him. But within it, unfortunately, then when that occurred, they all folded immediately. So no one ever really had my back there. And thanks to the internet, thanks to people like Willis Cardo, thanks to people like Matt Heimbeck, I have been able to carve out a career without leaving my field at all, and not being a part of any university life. And that's a tremendous achievement. That's probably one of the biggest achievements I've ever accomplished, because most people, you know, in the grad schools right now will say that that's not possible. You get a PhD in history or political science or philosophy, you're going to need to stay in academia. That's what you're trained to do. But I have carved out a niche for myself here, and I think other grad students in my position can do the same. And the internet has been the way that this has been done. So the Orthodox Nationalist is a radio show. And by the way, I want to clear something up. I keep reading that people are saying that I am calling myself the Orthodox Nationalist, like it's a superhero name, like Captain America. You know, tell them to shut up. It's the name of the show. It's like the name of a journal. I'm not calling myself that. You know, I'm not wearing T-shirts that you know, that's so, you know, I've come across that three or four times now. That is not who I am. It's what I might believe. It's the title of this show, but that's not a title that I give myself, like you know, Superman. My website is rushjournal.org. Many of you remember that it used to be rushjournal.com. But now, thanks to Matt Parrott and a few others, I have a new one where most of my recent essays are to be found, as well as copies of these podcasts, as well as biographical information and things like that. So it's rushjournal.org. The initial title of that years ago was the American Journal for Russian and Slavic Studies, which was the title of my first website in, I think that was 2004 or 5, and even earlier than that. But that changed over the years, and that explained the name. So I do want to thank Matt Parrott and a few others who've helped me in that regard. And this show deals exclusively with questions of orthodoxy and nationalism, as the show title might have told you, concerning Russia, Ukraine, and the Slavic world. And this has to do with the fact that regardless of the many sins and errors of those people, they clearly are a chosen group, no different than Israel. It's not an accident. I mean, history is not, you know, providence doesn't make accidents. And they're a chosen group of people. It's not an accident that Russians and Ukrainians are the core of the Orthodox world, along with Bulgarians and Serbs and Greeks. But in terms of numbers and power, Russia and Ukraine dwarf them, for better or for worse. Therefore, it's not irrational from an Orthodox point of view to say that this is a chosen group of people for some reason. And therefore, from a Christian point of view, they are the center of the world. The world exists for the faith. The world revolves around the faith. It keeps the world in one piece, and it's the purpose of history. And for those few of us who remain faithful to the true Orthodox idea, the world was created for us. And that's not something to be happy about, because it also means that we're going to be attacked. We're going to be suffering to a great extent. What's happened to me when I stopped doing the show in 2012, I'll spare you the details, but it almost killed me. The demonic attacks that I came under were so severe that I really shouldn't be here. You know, if I didn't believe in things like grace and God's power back then, I certainly do now, because that's the only explanation. I've never been one to be taken by flights of fancy or, wispy idealism. I've always been very concrete, and I am absolutely convinced that that's the only reason I'm here. In 1995, I finished my master's program at the University of Missouri at St. Louis and began the doctoral program at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. And I ended up there because Warren Buffett, you know, he's the most famous alumnus of the institution, was giving out tons of fellowships to promising grad students. And I apparently was one of them. So I received several fellowships to go to Lincoln, and they were very generous. And I certainly don't regret taking them. But at that point in my life, I was a Roman Catholic, but I wasn't certain. And I hated not being certain about it. So I said that I'm going to do nothing but read the church fathers, the councils. I'm going to read pagan opinion, Jewish opinion in the Roman Empire for the first 400 years of Christianity. And possibly a few centuries prior to Christ's advent. And I'm not going to stop until I'm convinced of the truth of one group or another. And I don't care what I have to do. This is my mission. And that's what I did for 2 years. Oh, not quite 2 years. Now, several things had to be in order for that to happen. Number one, I was already trained in Plato and Aristotle. So that meant when people like, you know, Maximus the Confessor or St. Basil use words like form or law or energy, I knew what they meant. The church fathers wrote in such a way that they just assumed that their readers are going to know this language and are part of the same intellectual milieu as they are. This is not something that someone who is not trained in Plato and Aristotle, Plotinus, can just pick up. You're not going to know the terminology. So I was in a good position for that, number one. Number two, Love Library, Lincoln, Nebraska, is one of the largest research libraries in the Midwest. And this is pre-internet, just pre-internet. And so they had everything. They had absolutely everything you could possibly want. And number three, of course, I was a grad student in both history and political science, so I was in a perfect position to begin doing this work. And number four, very importantly, I was always a gifted student, considered a gifted student as a kid, because I read very fast. You know, I could just glance. I look at a page or a long paragraph the same way someone else will look at a word. It looks like an object to me. They're not separate words. It's just a thing. When I was a kid, it even used to have colors. But now it's just, if I look at a long paragraph, I just see one object and I comprehend what it means. So that's just a gift that I had. I used to think it was normal as a kid. So all those things mean that I was in the perfect position to start this struggle. So from January of 1995 to, I would say, early October, late September of 97, this is all I did. I lost 30 pounds. I was drinking so much coffee, I should have gone into cardiac arrest. If I was onto something, I wouldn't sleep. I didn't sleep for days on end. My mother thought that I was going to die. She was very worried about me, and my response was, well, then I die, because this stuff is far more important than my life. I am not going to be uncertain. And I read a ridiculous amount of material. And at the end of the summer of 1997, doing nothing else, for the last year and a half, almost 2 years, I came to the conclusion that the Greek Orthodox were right. So I'm in a position now to say that I don't believe that they're right. I know that they're right. And I will put my knowledge and studies up against anyone living or dead. And I went through that torture, and it was painful. I lost a lot of friends during that period of time. People thought I was crazy. It was like A Beautiful Mind, one of my favorite movies, probably for that reason. I don't have any mental illness, but you know, people thought I did at the time. And I told my fellow grad students, excuse me, this is why we're here. You know, what are you here for? That you should be doing the same sort of thing in your area. So I eventually had to stop this, you know, especially since I wasn't eating well and everything. I was just on every kind of amphetamine you can imagine, just to stay awake, you know, to make sure that I mastered a certain concept or a certain author. And after not quite 2 years, I could no longer resist the notion that the Greek Orthodox, we would call today the Greek Orthodox Church, was the correct one. And that was not, it wasn't a voluntary decision. I had no good reason to become Orthodox other than that I read myself into it, and I convinced myself that that was the case. I converted to Orthodoxy involuntarily. I converted to Orthodoxy right afterwards, based on the fact that I had gone through all of the ridiculous mountains and mountains of material, until I was satisfied that one group or another was right, whether it be the Jews or the pagans or the Greeks or the Latins or the Muslims. Because I did read some Islamic stuff, which is much, you know, after 500, but I wanted to include them as well. So I'm absolutely certain of my decision, and that gets clarified and deepened all the time. So if that's the case, then Russia is a chosen people of God. Now, you need to understand that I'm not a Slav. I think there's a Metapedia page that says I am. I'm 100% Irish. My ancestry paternally is from Tyrone, and maternally is from County Longford. So there is no question. And they came to America as refugees, of all things, not as immigrants. During the Civil War, after the 1921 treaty. So wanting to escape that, my grandmother and grandfather left Ireland. So I wanted to tell you that to understand that the truth is out there. The truth is available. You have to know where to look, and you have to know the vocabulary that these authors are using and are assuming that you know. You can't just pick up, you know, St. Basil just because you feel like it. But worst of all, and this is something that Seraphim Rose said more than once, don't use these guys as weapons. Don't use a quote or a slogan from a church father to beat up somebody with. That is not what these guys wrote for. They are always out of context. The Greek language, as well as the Slavic language, is very context-based. You can't take one sentence out and have it mean anything. You can in English, but you cannot in Greek or Slavic, especially Slavic, any of the Slavic languages. They are very, very they are very context-based. Things only make sense when you understand what the topic is, what the other sentences around it are saying. So never use the church fathers, a line here and a line there because you're trying to win an argument. I mean, I've done that myself. I understand that you want to do this. People are stupid, but don't do it because it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't answer the question. And especially in these languages, you can't use a line or two and expect it to mean anything. Context is even more in Greek than it is in English. And even in English, context is everything. Historians do one thing. They situate people in events within their context, and they try to understand people and the decisions that they make in the same way that those people understood themselves. Unfortunately, today, there is a tendency to look at history as a morality play, that there's bad guys and there's good guys, and that the bad guys are irredeemably evil and can do nothing right, and that the good guys have the most holy motives. And this happens all the time, especially in 20th century history. And in my refusal to teach history that way is one of the reasons I'm not in academia anymore. That is not what historians do. That's not what history is. I was teaching at Mount St. Mary's University. I taught there for 5 years. And there's a woman there who claims to be a medievalist. And she was lecturing on a Gregorian style church, talking about the architecture. I asked her about her views on sacred geometry and the symbolism of the numbers and the ratios that they use in the construction of this temple. And she didn't know what I meant. And I said, well, I'm talking about how Pythagoras and Plato used the word number. They didn't mean numerals, right? And she looked at me and I said, are you kidding me? You have tenure here? And I said, you understand that the ratios, especially 3/2, are extremely important in early medieval Europe, not just because it was useful, but because it represents the Trinity and over the two natures of Christ. Plus the fact that the number 3 and the number 2 are intensely deep, profound icons of the world. They're not just numbers. It's not just 2 of something or 3 of something. And I called her incompetent. I said, how dare you teach here, you fool, if you don't know this very basic concept concerning the mentality and the ideals and the ideology of the early medieval world. Well, needless to say, I got into a lot of trouble about that, and I stood my ground, and I said, this is my job. This is what historians do. This is about knowledge and truth, and I don't think she should be teaching here. I did have, at the time, several patrons and protectors at the university who are gone now, and they kept me there. But there was quite a campaign to get rid of me for that. And then I challenged several people to a public debate, me against them, over these issues in front of the entire student body. And I said, you know what? I'll do it without any notes or books. I'll just be me. You can bring whatever you want, and I'll do it that way. And, of course, they said no, because they knew that I would have shredded them into next week. There wouldn't be enough self-esteem counselors in Maryland to put them back together after I was finished with them. And, that might give a certain window into my personality. But my personality, though, only in my field and in these areas. Basically what I said at the time was, students are not getting an education. They're not getting their money's worth here. If you have people who don't know the basic concepts, literally the basic building blocks of early medieval Europe, and so history majors and people who have to take these courses are getting incompetence and stupidity and error rather than fact, and they're spending a lot of money to come here. So I would recommend that this be ended, or else you may end up being sued. You can't give a false product for that much money for a long period of time. And needless to say, my I was there for a long time, but my days there were numbered. But what I'm trying to say here is that what's happening, whether it be this radio show, the Barnes Review, the real truth is coming out outside of the universities, outside of the establishment journals, outside of the establishment newspaper. The great news is that Americans and people planet-wide are not taking the establishment seriously anymore. When the biggest argument that these professors can give is to point to their own authority, then you know that they've lost. One of the things that I've learned in that and many other incidents like that is that these people have never heard anyone like me before. They've never heard our position stated competently before, certainly not nationalism or national socialism or orthodoxy or Russian nationalism or anything like that. They've never heard that stated competently ever. And they are very, very soft. They don't know what it is to debate someone like me, and so they lose. They lose right away, and they end up getting flustered, and they stutter, and they get angry, and they try to take disciplinary action against them, which makes them look stupider. That's actually good news. They are so protected. They're so ensconced. They're so spoiled. They're used to pontificating to a captive audience. So I've gone on here for quite some time only because these are essential concepts for any historian in 2016 America, or Western Europe as well. These are things that we have to know. That, number one, the academy, major newspapers and journals, these aren't to be taken seriously. There are very good professors out there and very good journalists out there, but in general, it's propaganda. Number two, the universities are simply failing to do their job. They are not teaching. Many of them aren't teaching at all. They're using PowerPoints and stupid things. They don't even know how to lecture anymore. And number three, college education is not worth what it used to be. So finally, number four, people who really want to get into history, not propaganda, not ideology, but history, which is an ascetic labor, which is a difficult labor, are going to be kicked out of every institution they have anything to do with. They at least have the realization that they're right, that they can't be beaten in debate over these issues, and that at some level, their opponents realize that they have no right to have the offices that they have. The phenomenon, whether it be the victories of Putin in Russia, Lukashenko in Belarus, and Trump in America, we're getting to the point where no one is taking these establishment institutions seriously, and it's one of the greatest sea changes in my lifetime and in the history of this country. And so I have gone from being very, very pessimistic to very, very optimistic. We will be vindicated. Now, that preface being completed, I will actually get to my topic for today. On this show in years past, I have dealt with the Cossack host in Ukraine. When you use the word Cossack, you're referring to a number of different groups. You can be referring to the Cossack Sikh, which is the national headquarters of the most radical Orthodox populace way beyond the rapids to the Dnieper River. You can be talking about the Cossacks and their administration on the right bank, the Dnieper, or the left bank, two very different groups of people. After the death of Khmelnytsky, both of those began to split into numerous factions. And Ukrainian historians rightly call that period of time the ruin. And we're talking about the 17th century. And I want to deal with someone here that's in the middle of that, dying in 1680. My favorite hetman meaning the chieftain, military chieftain of the Cossack host, the head of the radical Sikh in Ukraine, Ivan Sirka. If you don't read Ukrainian, unfortunately, you're not going to know much about him. He did things with a handful of men that should give us a great degree of hope. Ukraine at the time was considered one of the most strategic areas of the planet. It was claimed by Poland, it was claimed by Turkey, it was claimed by Russia, and it was claimed by the Cossacks, who represented Ukrainian-Ruthenian-Russian land. I don't want to see, and the Cossacks did use the word Ukraine to refer to themselves, but they used to. They also used, Rusyn as well. There's nothing wrong with using the term Ukraine. The events since 2014 in Ukraine have given Ukrainian nationalism a terribly bad name. That doesn't mean that it's illegitimate. It is legitimate. It is orthodox. It doesn't need to be anti-Russian at all. However, the Russian elite treatment of the Cossack host in Ukraine has been terrible in historically, whether it be especially in the St. Petersburg era, but also in the Moscow era, that many of the great hetmans of the Cossack hosts in different parts of Ukraine were vehemently anti-Russian for this reason. It didn't necessarily mean that they were pro-Turkish or pro-Polish, but it makes it very, very complicated for a historian to keep track. The period of time we're talking about, 1660s, 1670s, where everyone, who had a mace in their hand was claiming to be a hetman of something, that these alliances were constantly shifting. They were extremely complicated. Now, we can say with clear definition that the Cossacks were absolutely Orthodox. That was a requirement to be a member. They were religious, and they maintained the fasts very strictly. They had their own church administration. They had their own churches. They viewed themselves as a national church. No one would dare say that this is non-canonical or anything, nonsense like that. They simply, and they were quite simple because, the Cossacks were always on the move. And that's the first thing that you could say about them with absolute certainty. The second thing is that their mission was defense of Orthodoxy and Slavdom from the outside world, especially the Turks. They got their beginnings in rescuing Christian slaves from the Jewish slave centers within the Turkish Empire. That's how they got their start. They really were the swashbuckling heroes that we read about elsewhere. Number three, their primary enemy were the Jews. This is because, whether it be in the Turkish Empire or in the Polish Empire, both groups of people relied on Jewish money to maintain themselves. That the Jews at the elite level, I'm talking about, the elite, the leaders of the Kahal system in both parts of the world, had made themselves indispensable. That led to the Kahal being the leaseholder for churches and monasteries and Christian properties. And it didn't take long for them to make themselves hated. They were deep into the liquor business. They were involved in tricking peasants out of their land. They made themselves hated very, very quickly. So when the great hetman Bogdan Khmelnytsky rose up in the 17th century, he went after the Poles as well as the Jews. Poles and Jews worked. It was an uneasy alliance, but it was a clear alliance, and it was a long-standing alliance. And I could say the same about the Ottoman Turks. In both cases, especially in the Turkish areas, the slave trade was solely and exclusively a Jewish matter. That meant that when the Cossacks would invade the island of Kaffa, which was a big slave mart, which I believe at one point was part of the Khazar Empire, and the Khazars themselves were deep in the slave trade, they were fighting Jews. Now, many people, were Turks or the Italian merchant cities like Florence or Venice, were profiting from this. That's true. But the Jews were the middlemen. They extended the credit. They were involved with this trade at the most intimate levels. So automatically, you're going to have a great degree of contempt between Cossack Slavs on the one hand and Jews on the other. And the fact that the Jews had, were an extremely important part of the economics of both the Polish and the Ottoman empires, there's no question that Cossacks are going to hate them. I need to remind my listeners that up until the 20th century, the concept of Antichrist, that is to say, the Antichrist of the last times, really was a reference to the Jews as a group. In the Kabbalah, Adam Kadmon is their ideal restructured man, the primordial man. This is the individual that Revelations or Daniel was talking about as the Antichrist of the last times. It needn't be an actual person. It can be an institution. It can be a group. And at the elite levels, despite all their infighting, Jews they do act as one man. From our point of view, they act as one man. Internally, I'm from a Jewish area in New Jersey. I know the Jews very well. They're fighting all the time. If they didn't have us, they'd have killed each other a long time ago. We're what keeps them in one piece. In Russia, Turkey, Poland, they were organized into the Kahal system. That is to say, these communes with the rabbinate as a leadership, and the Talmud is their constitution. That's how they function. They didn't function as individuals. And this is what pooled resources and their international organization was very impressive. Possibly only the Vikings had a better one. Their centers were Krakow in Poland, Amsterdam, throughout Northern Europe and Amsterdam in particular, Constantinople with Kaffa as their big slave mart. And this, and eventually it also moved at some point to London as well. This created a huge network, an ethno-nationalist group speaking a language that no one else spoke, which was Yiddish, of course, not Hebrew. And they were able to offer rates far better than anybody else. And for a government, for an elite, it's like catnip. They can't turn that down. So, as far as Ukraine is concerned, the Jews, unfortunately, earned the hatred that they, born anywhere else, I think, earned the hatred that they received. And rebellions of the Cossacks consistently on Ukrainian territory, as long as they've been in existence, have been aimed at the Jews as the financiers of their other enemy. And in this case, we're talking about the period after the death of Khmelnytsky. We're talking about the 1660s and 70s and 80s. Ivan Sedekha died in 1680. And it is extremely chaotic. Turkey and Poland were of immense power. And in both cases, the Jews were very important. Slave trade was not nearly as important in 1680 as it was centuries earlier. But the Jews were still seen and factually were exploiters of the Slavic people and the Polish people as well, who were all Slavs, but a very, very different group of people. Keep in mind something else, too. And I want you to realize that Poland, I may have mentioned this before, but Poland as a nation is not a relevant term. In this period, Poland was a group of elites, nobles, oligarchs, who occasionally would organize into confederations to fight a common enemy. There was no central Polish government. There was no central Polish army. There was no central Polish budget. They met in a diet, in their parliament, but it was a highly decentralized oligarchy. And that decentralization and their obsession with the fact that these elites were obsessed with one thing, that a monarch, a Polish monarch, if he won enough battles and became popular as a result, would take their privileges away. The Polish elites and confederations were literally deliberately losing battles or refusing to fight at all so that a monarch would look bad. And this is how obsessed it was. And this is why the Polish Empire fell apart and was then partitioned in the late 18th century. And in the much older Orthodox nationalist, I have at least one show about this topic, and it's tragic. And something else you need to know about the Poles as well is that their oligarchs did not see themselves as Polish ethnically. Sarmatia was this ethnic myth that they had that made them descendant from this Aryan warrior elite, and the Slavs were the peons that were under them. The Polish sort of the Polish and Hungarian types of serfdom were the harshest in the world. They were identical to slavery. But you really can't do that to one of your own people. So over time, they developed this absurd myth that they are part of this noble band of warriors from elsewhere, and hence have no real ethnic connection to the peasants underneath. You can't treat your own people that way. Your conscience would get to you. And so they invented this mythology. So keep that in mind. Also keep in mind that empires are not nation states. Empires don't function in the same way. If you're talking about parts of the Russian Empire, for example, the Russian Empire related to Finland, for example, or Poland in the 19th century. It's not the same thing as talking about how Washington, D.C. relates to Florida. There is not that direct control. In the Russian Empire, Finland and Poland had their own constitution. They had their own way of life. They were completely independent in everything but foreign policy. So any kind of rebellion against Russian rule can only be artificial. Russia didn't rule these parts of its empire. They may have been able to control certain aspects of their foreign policy, but otherwise they were completely independent. So don't treat empires like nations. at the same time, Cossacks are something completely different. They did develop a state system, although because they're nomadic horsemen, they found that difficult. The greatest thing, the Sikh system was very decentralized, very populist, very egalitarian. When they began to settle, once they, Khmelnytsky won his victory against the Polish Empire, and they began to form their own state in Ukraine, central Ukraine, the old Cossack ethos began to wane, and they began to be used to positions of power, land holding, and being serf owners themselves, completely destroying the whole concept of what a Cossack is. This is why the Sikh, the great fortress in the rapids of the Dnieper, became so important. They were the most radical, and they were always reminding the rest of the Cossack world that you cannot settle down with, your serfs and your money while our people are suffering elsewhere. This is the exact negation of what a Cossack is. Unfortunately, at this period of time, 1660s, 1670s, the Cossack organization had fallen apart completely. There is no way that I can summarize it all here, the number of players that existed and their claims. Suffice it to say that some of the hetman were pro-Russian. Some were pro-Polish, and one, Doroshenko, was pro-Turkish. Now, when I say pro, I don't mean that they believe that they should be ruled by them or that they were even sympathetic to them. But by pro, I mean they were willing to make an alliance with that nation or empire in order to guarantee their own independence. And as some of you know, Ivan Mazepa made an alliance with Sweden. And so there were factions in the Cossack organization throughout Ukraine divided by a bunch of different things. But the main thing was that they had leanings towards one empire or another. So those like Ivan Verkhovsky, who was Khmelnytsky's successor and right-hand man, had moved to Poland, believing that Poland would be a better guarantee of Cossack independence than Russia would be. His enemies that were more pro-Russian had condemned him, claimed that he had converted to Catholicism, stuff like that. So this is how it went back and forth. But there's so many people, and it's very difficult to keep track of them. Even full-time people like me are always struggling. It's like trying to keep Pope's name straight. I'm going to summarize this stuff very, very quickly, we may get into more detail later on. So why do I want to talk about Ivan Sirko? His name is spelled S-I-R-K-O, and he is, as I've mentioned, the hetman of the Danube, the Zaporozhian Sikh, or the fortress. He is extremely radical. The Turks called him the Beast, and always had a massive bounty on his head. Ivan Sirko is one of the great military tacticians of all time. And I'm going to tell you why here in a minute. There's a lot of mystery that surrounds this man. And the mystery has more to do with Russia's treatment of him. Russians have never quite trusted the Cossacks, any faction at this time, because they knew how quickly one group can move to another. And that if they're irritated by Russia too much, they'll go to Poland or even Turkey. Bogdan Khmelnytsky's son was named Yuri. Generally speaking, he is considered a very poor leader. He wanted to be a monk, but he was one of the actually relatively minor hetman of the Cossack host that struck a deal with Russia right after the death of his father. The problem with doing that is if the Cossack forces make a deal with Russia and they're too close to Poland, that guarantees a war with Poland. In 1661, Russia had defeated Poland in that resulting war. In that particular case, the Polish confederations had gone to Turkey. Turkey was always this wild card. When I say Turkey, I'm talking not only about the Ottoman Empire, but also the Tatars in Crimea. The Crimean Tatars were a vassal of the Ottoman Sultan. There are two other players here. Rokovetsky, who is more pro-Russian, and Teteria, feel was probably the most pro-Polish of all of them. In 1664, those two opposed the Zaporozhian Sikh under Ivan Serkin. He was seen as a great threat. He supported the peasant rebellions in Russia. I have not been able to pin this down, but he may have been an old believer because after 1666, because he did support Razin and other people who maintained the old faith in Russia. But I don't know if he personally was one. In 1664, when you have the pro-Polish faction and the pro-Russian faction attacking you, you must be doing something either very right or very wrong. Unfortunately, Russia's behavior, as well as Poland's behavior in Ukraine, was very poor and very irrational. The Poles also, I should note, to show their contempt for Ukraine, did give their Tartar allies, really mercenaries, permission to loot and to do whatever they wanted. And in fact, if they were running out of money, what they would do is say, well, we'll give you permission to loot in exchange for actually getting a salary from us. Another very major figure is Peter Doroshenko. I mentioned him before. He eventually went to the Turks and is either, depending on how you view Ukrainian history, he's either very famous or very infamous. He defeated the Poles, and as a result of that, Ivan Serka had no choice but to do the same. Now, there's a treaty, one of the most infamous ones, the Treaty of Andrusovo, which completely canceled any Cossack or Ukrainian independence whatsoever. It divided the entire country between Poland and Russia. So if you were a hetman, any hetman of Ukraine at the time, and Doroshenko was the main one, he didn't think he had any other option but to go to Turkey. Because when your two long-standing enemies make peace only when it comes to oppressing you, then you're obviously a threat and you're obviously in a lot of trouble. Doroshenko acted with the best of intentions. He brought to Ukraine a large Turkish army. He tried to control them. He used them as a way to unify the country, to get rid of both the Russian army as well as the Polish army, and to reestablish a unified Ukraine where both right bank and left bank were unified. And he's one of the few men who actually was able to do that. That treaty also increased serfdom to formerly free people in Ukraine, which is one of the worst things, especially in the Polish case. The Treaty of Andrusovo divided the entire country between Poland and Russia. Both, of course, were in different ways, Poland far worse than Russia, using serf labor, at least at the elite levels. And the worst thing you can do is to bring a free person who's used to being free under serfdom. That's especially the case if you're of a different nationality and different religion. In that particular case, the Polish aristocracy had no problem in oppressing you. Polish serfdom, because there was no great central power for the most part, were completely free to exploit their serfs. That was not the case in Russia. This is something that Serka disagreed with. Doroshenko's attempt to liberate Ukraine by using the Turks, as you may imagine, was a disaster. I don't believe that Doroshenko meant that to happen. I think he was desperate. I think a lot of us in his position would have done the same thing. The Sultan promised him all kinds of, we're not going to do anything wrong, we're not going to loot, we're not going to, you know, and yet that's not what happened. And Doroshenko, while true, for a brief period of time, liberated the country, brought in a huge Turkish force, and drove both the Poles and the Russians out. Liberated both right and left banks. And yet now, Ukraine has a huge Turkish army inside of it, and they're not behaving well. He became very unpopular very quickly. However, it was the Treaty of Andrusovo that forced him to do this. Now, as this is going on, Ivan Serka has one thing in mind. He is going to destroy the Turkish Empire by himself. For some reason, he is constantly under attack from the Russians. He was sent to Siberia for this idea. And then when Doroshenko's Turks began rampaging throughout Ukraine, the people high and low level Cossacks were begging Moscow to bring Serko back, because they knew that if there's one person who can destroy these people, it's Serko. In 1674, Ivan Serko destroys this Turkish army. The more pro-Russian hetman at the time, Samoilovich, had refused to help him at all. His reasoning probably was that in defeating this very large army, remember, Cossacks are used to being outnumbered. You know, their martial arts are based on, you know, lots of trickery, lots of deceit and things, guerrilla methods, and you know, because they were always outnumbered. They're usually fighting on foreign soil, and they had developed a mentality where being outnumbered was simply something that they always had to deal with. Samoilovich didn't want Serko to be too powerful. He was well aware that Serko was capable of destroying Turkish armies much, much bigger than his own. But there is nothing that could cement a ruler in power like a victory like that, especially a victory that seems miraculous. But that wasn't enough. Serko did destroy the Turkish army. A year later, 1675, the elite Janissary Corps was sent to Ukraine, and Serko destroyed that. He destroyed that and lost only 15 men in the process. This is unheard of. His methods, his sneak attacks, his padding his horse's hooves so that they wouldn't make any noise. This is how he did it. The Janissaries, some of you know, were the elite cavalry as well as infantry of the Turkish Empire. They were taken as babies from their mothers, involuntarily, of course, from the Balkans, from other parts of the empire, and raised at the capital as Muslim soldiers. There was sort of like the SS would be in Germany, or the Guardians would be in Plato's Republic. They're not to have families. They're not to have any connections. They exist solely for Islam and the Turkish Empire. They never know where they're from. They don't know who their parents are. They have no idea who they are, except they're soldiers in the Sultan's army. They are always the most fanatical. They're always the most effective. And they were the elite core of the Ottoman Empire. As the Ottoman Empire fell apart, the Janissaries usually turned on the Sultan, who was seen as not militant enough. So when a relatively small force from the Sikh in Ukraine defeats the main Janissary force, losing only 15 men, this is the reason why the Turks thought that he was demonic. They thought that he was channeling demonic power, because that can't happen unless some power. Now, we, of course, say that he was protected by grace. The Turks, needless to say, will say the opposite, that he was protected by Satan. So they began calling him that, and that became his nickname. And by that time, so by 1675, the bounty on Serko's head was huge. So now Turkey has lost two armies. He drove the Turkish and Tartar force from Ukraine. Doroshenko attempts to bring them back in again. Again, Serko is now the biggest threat to everyone but actual Ukrainians. He has now already achieved legendary status with these victories. 1678, a third massive Turkish Tartar army invades Ukraine. Again, Serko has no help from anyone. They deliberately just throw him to the wolves. It seemed like Russia was using Turkey to bring to destroy the Cossacks and bring Ukraine under itself. And Serko destroyed now this third army. Ivan Serko, with a few thousand men, destroyed three major infantry and cavalry armies sent into Ukraine. That was it. Their elite corps was gone, and their main forces now were gone or in panic. Turkey was in serious trouble. Turkey, as well as the Crimean leadership, began to crumble. If you lose three massive armies like that, and you're the leader, you're the Sultan of Turkey, you're not going to be taken seriously anymore. The institutions of the Ottoman Empire began to fall apart. Not only was the Sultan now in panic, not only was he unprotected, and you know, there was now a straight shot from Ukraine straight to the capital of the Ottoman Empire, and no one could stop Sarkis. But the institutions, the empire itself was falling to pieces. Obviously, these victories of Sarkis are not going unnoticed in other parts of the empire, parts of North Africa and Arabia. Turkey is actually falling to pieces because of this man. Now, you know, if you don't read Ukrainian, you don't know this story, which is a big, big mystery to me. And what is Russia's response? You would think it should be joy and happiness. No. As the Sultan is beginning to panic, considering fleeing the capital, because this one small band of Cossacks has destroyed his entire military, including his elite forces, Russia's response is to destroy the Zaporozhian Sich. Now, when I say destroy, you know, it was temporary. It wasn't until Catherine II in the late 18th century that she finally destroyed the that particular Cossack organization permanently. But Russia then attacks the Sich and destroys it temporarily. That's their response to this. And this is what is a bit of a mystery to me. The only thing that makes any sense is that they are afraid that someone like Serka, obviously a genius, obviously a man of such tremendous ability, that he is a threat to everyone, including Russia itself. That if there's any man who could unify Ukraine, who could be a hero of the people, and remember, this man's political ideology was firmly populist, communalist, ethno-nationalist, religious nationalist, agrarian. You know, he was a man of the people. He is not from the Cossack elite. He joined later on. He was an ordinary guy. So not only are these empires now threatened by this guy, but their ideological foundations are being threatened. Unfortunately, it doesn't make Russia at the time look very good. Everyone knows how pro-Russian I am, but their refusal to work with this guy is the reason that the Turkish Empire continued in its existence. Nothing seems to change. I mean, we realize that right up until World War I, anytime the Ottoman Empire looked like it was crumbling for good, some European power would come in and prop it up. And most of the time that was Great Britain, but during the war itself it was Germany. The British opinion was that any victory for Russia whatsoever of any kind, even if it benefited them, was to be fought, was wrong, was evil. There is an absolutely demonic hatred for the British elite, and Masons in London, against anything Russian. Nothing has changed. The Ottoman Empire needed to be maintained at great expense to London, because if it crumbles and falls apart, Russia will then expand into those areas, especially the Balkans, and possibly even the Middle East. Rather than, you know, working with them to destroy these empires and expand their own influence, Britain, for many centuries, is doing whatever it can to prop up this constantly ailing empire, this very poor, and, you know, by 1900, the Ottoman Empire was a joke. It fell apart immediately at the start of World War I. And I can say the same about Austria. You know, there's a lot to admire about the Austrian Empire in Vienna, but it was tottering, and World War I brought it to an end, and it fell apart. The Russians knocked it out of the war right away. After finally destroying Sarkis, he did not die a natural death. They needed to get rid of him. He was a threat. Russia then goes and forms the Holy League against the Turkish Empire. So they destroy the man who actually had a straight shot right to the Sultan, who was in the process of fleeing the capital. They destroy him. They destroy the Cossacks as much as they possibly can, especially the Sich. And then they form the Holy League so as to fight the Turkish Empire. In other words, if the Turkish Empire is going to be fought, it's going to be by us, and it's going to be under our terms. Unfortunately, in that particular case, the Russian Empire rescued the Ottoman state. And they rescued the Ottoman state because in order to give someone like Ivan Sarkis any kind of power at all, it would have threatened, especially given the time period. Now, this is post-Nikon. The divisions between old right and new right were substantial and very political. The fact that Serka had supported Razin did bother the empire in Moscow. And so you're talking about an old believer populist. Again, I don't know if he was an old believer theologically. Probably a good reason for him to be. Generally speaking, the Cossacks overwhelmingly were old believers, even now. But especially the Cossack forces in the south were mostly a priestly old believer group. So it's very possible. Most of the Cossacks at the time and even today were old believers. But that also meant that they were populist, that they were nationalist, that they were communitarian in the best sense of the word. It was a threat. Serka is destroyed. The man who, with a handful of people, destroyed the Turkish Empire single-handedly. And then in rescuing Turkey, not to mention the fact that Russia had also created this alliance with Poland, dividing Ukraine between it and Polish Empire. Then they formed the Holy League as almost a mocking gesture. Clearly, destroying the Turkish Empire was not their primary concern. Destroying a populist Cossack Orthodox leader, on the other hand, was far more important. It is depressing, but Ivan Serka should give us a great degree of hope. Numbers don't matter. Cohesion matters. Ivan Serka is a great man, one of the great military tacticians of all time, and he lived at a time of such chaos and such duplicity that even someone like Tsar Alexis, who was a great man in many, many ways, saw him as a threat, or at least was told that he was a threat. Anyway, I am finished for today. I do appreciate you listening. As always, I close by saying that I thank my enemies. You are stupid and you're arrogant and you don't know what you're talking about, but you do keep me on my toes and I do appreciate that. Loving our enemies is a command that Christ gave us, but love can mean many, many things. It certainly doesn't mean indulgence. Thank you for listening and I will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.